Hey, everybody. It's Tuesday at 4, so it must be Voices from the Front Lines. This is your host, Eric Mann. And the beat goes on. I think you know this is a social justice show that focuses, as we say, on voices from the front lines. And we're excited about today's show, as we are about every show, because Crystal McMillan, the producer, and I, we do a lot of work thinking up what you would like and also what's good for you, you know, because we're your health food doctors and we only serve you good stuff. So today, we have two interesting conversations. First is with Maria Guyton, who has written a really fine book called This Bright Light of Ours, Stories from the Voting Rights Fight. I think you know that the vast majority of guests we have on the Black Liberation Movement are black. But Maria also represents another very important tradition, the anti-racist whites, especially the anti-racist pro-revolutionary whites who went down south in the 60s, who, whether they went in favor of revolution, they came back in favor of revolution. And she's going to talk about her book, This Bright Light of Ours, and she's also going to be at Esalen Bookstore tonight at 7. So already plan to see if you could see her there tonight, get to buy a copy of her book and talk with her. And then the second half of the show, we're going to have a discussion about our dear friend Donald Sterling of the Los Angeles Clippers, who just got kicked out on his butt by Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, in an unusually bold, courageous action in which Sterling was pushed out because of racist remarks, but was in fact banned from the NBA for life. And as I'll read the statement, they're going to be pushing him to sell the team, whether he wants to or not. So hey, everybody, welcome to Voices from the Front Lines. Maria, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. This is Maria Guyton here, and glad to be here. It's a kind of an exciting day. My friends have been texting and calling about the planned protest at the Staples Center tonight. I guess the NAACP and some other good organizing groups are getting people out to say that they definitely agree with the NBA commissioner and don't want racist conversations like Donald Sterling was having to continue. So that's kind of a ray of hope here in L.A. today.
Well, just to add that, as we say, to respectfully disagree, that the Los Angeles NAACP was just on the verge of giving Donald Sterling his second Lifetime Achievement Award before this came out, knowing that he was a known racist who had been convicted by the Department of Justice. So in the particular case of the NAACP, as I'll talk about in the second half of the show, which you just didn't walk into, it seems fine on its face, I think it's an act of pure hypocrisy on the part of the Los Angeles NAACP to have not really fought for bus riders and not fought for poor people, to give awards to all kinds of Hollywood people, and then when they get caught in the most racist, egregious acts, then they're going to have a demonstration of support at the Staples Center. So we'll get that into Act Two. You just walked into L.A., so welcome to the culture of Voices from the Front Lines.
Thank you.
So your book is really good. I haven't read as much as I wanted to, but I'm just going to grab a section, and then you're going to go back, Maria Guyton.
Guyton.
All right. Maria, Guyton. I'm sorry, Maria Guyton.
Yes.
And it's important to get your guest's name right. And I want you to go back and tell us the introduction to this book after I just pick a section that I particularly like to read, okay?
Okay.
So on page 93, it says, "The Smiths, the family with whom you're working, had a nice little wooden house with electricity inside and pecan trees out front. Mrs. Smith may have dressed and pressed her hair like the proper school teacher and preacher's wife that she was, but she always welcomed us warmly, and her pecan pie ranked up there with Mrs. Crawford's. I loved 6-year-old Larry, who liked to play hide-and-seek among the trees. Skinny as he was, he could hide pretty well. Their son Frank was away at Morehouse College in Atlanta, and the attractive Smith daughters, 21-year-old Carolyn and 20-year-old Gwendolyn, Geraldine, and Gerald, came home from Alabama State College every weekend to help out. Reverend Smith seemed very strict with his children. I had no idea the kind of pressure he was under, so I just kept my distance. When we went out to canvass with Jesse Smith, who with the support of his parents was an active local leader at age 16, Bob, who was an important protagonist in this story of young civil rights love, explained that we, that was my parenthesis, should stand back and let Jesse take the lead. We didn't realize at the time how fortunate we were that he tolerated us with our outside attitudes. Some folks wouldn't open the door when they saw Jesse because his family members were known leaders in the movement. Him coming up the path with white civil rights workers put a scare into many who depended on whites for their livelihood. I was disappointed that not everyone was ready to join the movement. I didn't really understand the constant harassment they live with. I liked working out in the country with Bob. I especially liked that we were so well received and well fed at the Crawfords and the Smiths. It also felt safer out there. Most local men had guns. That is to say, most local black folks had guns, parenthesis, and they weren't afraid to use them. That wasn't what Dr. King preached, but it didn't take very long to understand that there wasn't going to be any other protection than God and guns. I prayed that God alone would keep us safe. Beautifully written. Before we even go further, just take us into that moment. Where were you then? And go through the whole process of how white folks go down to help black people, only to find out that much of it is about figuring out who we are.
That certainly is true. We were so, many of us were idealistic. I won't say that everyone was, because my boyfriend Bob, as you say, is the protagonist in this story. He was looking for some action. You know, he was hoping that there'd be, you know, violence and arrests, all of which he got to his satisfaction, and then some. But I really was very idealistic, and also really adhered to and trained in nonviolence, which I had studied through Quaker ancestries, and then at San Francisco State, where I was a freshman college student. And I was kind of horrified when I first encountered the more activist SNCC workers, because I was coming from the Southern Christian Leadership, SCLC side, rather than SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee side, initially. And then I realized that the people who lived there really were walking a very brave battle, where they had to do both. Sing, hope, and pray, and then have backup in case there was no protection, which, as it turned out, many times there was none except sticking together.
Well, you referred to the tension between the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, with which I was more identified. I was actually in the North with the Congress of Racial Equality, but we were very close with SNCC. And then the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which, of course, you were in the SCOPE project there, which is a voter education program you'll tell us about in Alabama. And this is in 65, not 64, just to be clear. How did you understand the tension there? I mean, we all sort of went in thinking we shall overcome, we're all in this together, and then you see, wow, there are these political disagreements. How did you understand them at the time?
At the time, I was very fortunate in that San Francisco State SNCC had an office on campus, which is actually where I heard about this project. And although they somewhat snickered at a little 105-pound white girl with long, stringy hair wanting to go south and help the poor benighted Negro, which was the term of respect at the time, as you may recall, and they were already definitely moving in the direction of black liberation, they were supportive. They loaned me the table and chair to sit out at the quad and recruit other people. They put an article in the newspaper saying that they endorsed the project, as long as our SCOPE project stayed out of their counties. And it's one of the reasons, besides personal reasons, that I wanted to write about that summer community organization and political education project, is almost nobody knows that it existed, even though we had nearly as many people as the Mississippi Freedom Summer of 1964. There were about 1,200 workers, 600 whites and 400 locals, and then about 250 staff people who worked in 60 counties in six states that summer, and many had experiences very much like mine.
Well, one of the things that I like about your book, and let me say, Maria, that I haven't read as much as I want to, but part of being a host of a show where a lot of authors want you to read their books is I can't read quite a book a week. So I open up and I get a feel for it, and I actually continue to read after the show. So for our friends tonight, you know, at Voices from the Frontlines, we always ask you to take action and not just listen. I think it'd be really important to come out and support Maria's presentation at Essawan, which we know is a black bookstore in South LA. You can see it online and get all the information about it. What time is the program tonight?
It's at 7 p.m., and I'm particularly honored that a longtime friend of my husband, Samuel Torres, that's my husband, went to law school with Judge Kelvin Filer, who is a very well-known and well-respected Superior Court judge in this region, and he has offered to introduce me. So I'm hoping he'll bring a posse of friends, and if people want to get in good with the African-American legal establishment, it might be another motivation to come. Besides, I've also brought music and some historic slides. Bob Fitch, who was a photographer with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference for many years and worked directly with Dr. King, had the good fortune for me, or my good fortune, that he came through my county, Wilcox County, Alabama, about 6 months after I was there, and took pictures of people they've never been shown, and they were unknown people. Now Bob Fitch is quite famous. His photograph is the model for King's statue in the National Mall, and his archives have just been acquired by Stanford University. He allowed me to use four of the photos of people that I personally knew. When we were down there, at least in my project, we weren't allowed to have cameras, so I didn't have any of my own pictures. So I think there'll be an interesting crossover turnout and then several of my husband's Latino law school buddies are also coming, and one of my young mentees who works for the Peter Drucker Institute. So we should have a very interesting cross-section of backgrounds and philosophies and orientations. To get back to your question a little bit about SNCC and SCLC, as I say, I left with a pretty positive feeling that we're in it together. And then when we got to our county, it turned out that SCLC was very established there. It had, in Wilcox, it had two adult field directors there for about 6 months because the locals were so organized that it was a community where they were putting in a lot of resources to reinforce the work that they were doing. And Selma SNCC had been sending people over at that time. Stokely Carmichael certainly had been over there somewhat, but my close friend was Charles Bonner, and he basically said, "We want to recruit you." So he had me and my boyfriend Bob Black join the Selma SNCC. So we were given pins and we were put on the roll, and they put us through the SNCC drills, which was to do, you know, criticism, self-criticism about, you know, my racist thoughts. And I thought it was just this wonderful education. I mean, the level of my naivete probably comes across in the book as almost embarrassing, but I would be very honest about it. And I wanted people to know that you don't have to have it all together or be some brilliant philosopher to create social change. But what I found was that these northern black students, and then, of course, the kids in the South who were in college, such as Charles Bonner, were also very deep into the philosophy and psychology of racism and the pathology, I should say, actually, of racism. And they were able to teach us so much, and I just absorbed it. I can't explain why I didn't get offended and take it personally when they said it was time to go. I know it was extremely painful for many white people. And, of course, once again, I was a tiny, short-time foot soldier who was there for 8 weeks for this project. It was intended to drop in, do a lot of work, and get out, thinking that it would change our lives and that we would go back and do other things, which indeed we did.
Well, I think that's a really good way to express. I mean, one of the things, you know, Lenin said that there's entire centuries in which a year happens, and there's entire years in which a century happened, mm-hmm. and I think we were very fortunate. There's almost no way I can explain to these wonderful young people with whom I'm working today, mainly black and Latino youth, many of them queer, many of them, but still in a whole nother time zone, that I can't explain to them that how do we understand the risks we took? How do we understand, and this is something I want to get back to, how do we understand black people taking us to school? Because so much of my consciousness is a product, you know, in my case, I work with the Corps for a year. I worked 3 years in the Newark Community Union Project. I've lived and worked in black communities most of my life. And I think black people have generally, not like white folks a whole lot, but have understood there's some really good ones. And the ones that are good, they're really tough on, because they're the ones who they think you're the one of the few who might understand this. So in your 8 weeks, looking back over 40 years, what are some of the things they were trying to teach you?
Well, it fortunately, because I was in this really well-organized project, which was one of the last large integrated projects of the civil rights movement, where all the lessons had been, so many of the lessons had been learned, we had orientations and briefings in Berkeley for a whole month before, my last semester, or my last month of that semester of my freshman year. I was going over and learning from African American leaders and also from various Unitarian ministers and theologians and so forth about the philosophy and history of racism, and I was trained before I even went that the role of white students was to support local leaders, to show respect from them for them, and to learn from them. So I felt that that was a very fortunate situation, where and maybe as a young woman, somewhat insecure from a poor family, not from a family of privilege, I felt fine to sit at the knees of a farmer or a housewife with a rag on her head while she was doing her housework, you know, explaining things to me and how I ought to be. I went back and re-met by telephone about 70 of the people, the families and people that I had interacted with over the period of the last 6 years, many of whose stories are included in this book, which I think is a real reason that it's of interest to people.
And well, let me go right there.
So many of them talked about how scared they were for us. You kids, you white kids came in here and you had no idea, and we felt that we had to take care of you, which was so counter to my original idea of I'm coming down to save the poor benighted black person.
Well, there's a lot of great stuff in the book. In terms of a picture's not worth is worth a thousand words, let's start with the picture on page 87 of Bob Crawford Sr., Wilcox County freedom fighter, 1960s. Who is he, and what effect did he have on you?
Well, Bob Crawford Sr. Is just one of the most amazing men, and I'm really fortunate that I got to know him because he housed my boyfriend Bob Block and then our SNCC leader, Charles Bonner, who I referred to earlier. He and his wife, Georgia Crawford, who we could not get a good picture of her, unfortunately. They were a ferocious team out in Pineapple, Alabama, a very, very rural area, where they had managed by farming, working. He worked in the sawmill. She took in ironing. She raised eggs and cream and sold pies and made quilts and did everything. They managed to get a piece of land and keep it in their family. And also, therefore, that because they owned their own property, they had the freedom, the relative freedom, to work in the movement and to house workers. And he just had this philosophy, even though he was in the state prison both before and after we left, he had this philosophy, and he always used to say, it don't matter if you're black or white as long as you're good people, and we have to stick together. And I think that goes to your point, Eric, that you made about, you know, that the African Americans that you met did give a hard time to whites who were open to working and learning how to be with them, but also understood that, you know, that we needed to stick together in some way to bring change about in this country, and certainly in that part of the country.
Well, you know, Maria, we're listening to Maria Gittin. Did I get it right this time?
Yeah.
All right, I'll keep working. You know what they say, keep working till you get it right. She's the author of This Bright Light of Ours, Stories from the Voting Rights Fight. Really terrific book, University of Alabama Press, I believe.
And yes, amazingly.
Yeah, amazingly. And these academic presses are doing some really, really great stuff. I got it on Amazon. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it, but more importantly, get it at SOR tonight in terms of supporting a local black bookstore that's really critical, trying to survive in the age of Amazon. So do turn out tonight at 7 o'clock to hear Maria. One of the things that I was very struck by when I was in Newark is one summer in Newark in 1965, I believe, when I got there was many as 40 or 50 white kids who came, including myself, to work in the black community in the north in Newark. And then 2 years later, I was still in the community, and Stokely Carmichael was saying, you know, it's time for whites to leave the community. Mm-hmm. And I was in many ways ready to go. I wanted to go on campuses to work with SDS. But some of the people in the community said, and this is just counterindicated, it's nice of Stokely to say that, but all the whites have left, Eric. There's only 7 of you. It's you, Tom Hayden, Carol Glassman, Steve Block, Corinna Fales. What are we talking about whites that are together? The whites, they came for the summer and they left. So for the few whites that were willing to stay, we'd like you to stay. The point is not whether it's true or not. It's just always the complexity of race relations for right. those of us who are lucky enough to, in some ways, be part of the black community. And I think, again, your book, even if it's just for a summer, I don't like white people in general. You know, I don't as a culture. And it's just nice to read a white person who I like. You know what I mean? Who a white person who went to the South and got it and who is vulnerable and tells the story in a very transparent manner, in an unarrogant manner, in an introspective manner, with a sense of humor and a sense of poetry. So just wanted to tell you that this is a particularly cool book. Let's go to page 52, Reverend Daniel Harrell, SCLC Scope, yes. Field Director, Antioch Baptist Church, Camden, Alabama. Understand this is by Bob Fitch's picture. I'm going off some of the pictures mm-hmm. in Maria's book. Why don't you tell us about Reverend Harrell?
Reverend Harrell is to this day one of, you know, that I know that cliche, unsung heroes or whatever, but he was on SCLC staff for 7 years, and before that he was actually with CORE in Baton Rouge during the bus boycotts and the sit-ins there and the walkouts from the university. Very, very dedicated and a true believer in the theory of nonviolence. He supported the youth in that community. The youth were very, very organized. There was a private Presbyterian academy that was taken over by the public school system as one of their many dodges to maintain separate but equal. However, he was able to then find out what the kids wanted and get various, you know, strategy support, even get a car to help take the kids over to the Selma marches. He and his wife Juanita brought the very first Head Start program to Alabama. I no longer am going to say that it was the first Head Start in the South because I've read three other unpublished scope manuscripts that all say that I worked in the first Head Start in the South that summer. So maybe a bunch of them started at once.
Right.
In any case, they were one of the very earliest ones. A wonderful, wonderful federal program. They also got an OCRA grant, a federal grant, with some of the early anti-poverty money for a OCRA canning cooperative for African Americans. Just tremendous, tremendous community organizing. And I do think that SCLC gets sold short sometimes on how good they were at community organizing. I don't know if you met or have read anything by Dorothy Cotton, but she's one of my heroes who I didn't get to know that well then, but in recent times have been lucky enough to be on various talks, panels, conferences where, you know, I'm on some small panel and she's the keynote speaker. We get to talk between dives. She's a terrific lady, and the thoughtfulness, and Septima Clark, of course, of blessed
right.
memory, who really organized and helped people think and talk their way through local issues to develop philosophies and strategies of change. And Dan was just brilliant, and he was a total optimist. I mean, I don't know if you got to the story yet where the man comes and holds the gun up to his head while he's with my boyfriend, and he just remains nonviolent. And the fellow, I have it memorized, I don't even have that page open, the fellow says, you know, I could just as soon shoot you as look at you, don't you know it? And Dan says, I believe I do.
I'm fortunate enough to have read that section. I'm really happy that I did. Let's stay on something here which goes right on to that. The aggressiveness of the white racist on page 130. You're talking about that. I want to skip to something else because this is more important, actually. Sorry, but your interaction with Paul Good and the combination of arrogance and alcohol leading you to make some political mistakes. I want to find the text, but you know it by heart.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us that story? Because it may shock you. You're not the only one who made that mistake, but it's a teachable moment. So why don't you tell the folks what we're talking about?
Okay. There were Northern reporters after Selma, so this is after Bloody Sunday and before the passage of the Voting Rights Act, while our project is going on. There's various reporters and photographers hanging around primarily in Selma, which is 37 miles away from where my county seat of Camden in Wilcox County was, looking for stories, looking for action, heading over to counties like Hale and others where there were demonstrations. And he came over looking to interview us and telling us that, and we were told, we had official spokesperson, and I was not one of them. So I said, I can't talk to you, but he had been, I guess, seeing a girl in my project. And he took the two of us, and we went to, I don't have time to tell the whole story, but long story short, we had some beers together, and he got me to speak off record. And, of course, I didn't know, because he'd said, he said, in fact, that it was deep background and it would not be in the press. Anyway, it was...
And Maria, I'm just going to read your quote. Is that okay, very quick?
Thanks.
So as you're talking, you say, my happiest days are working out there, she says, being Maria. But there's a lot of frustration with Scope. They spend too much time talking about organizing. There isn't enough action. I mean, the people here want to demonstrations against police brutality, but Scope leaders hold them back. Pretty deep.
Yeah, so I almost got thrown out because of that.
Yeah, and almost should have. You know, I mean, that's part of the problem is to be criticizing, you know, the people that you were with and almost implying that they weren't militant enough. And then I want to read what you learned from this. This painful media lesson stayed with me the rest of my life. Every activist's life is lived on the record. If you don't want it published, don't say it. Not that I've lived up to that ideal personally, but from then on, when I was involved in political or social justice action, I tried to stick to sound bites that could be on the front page of any paper or make no comment. And I'd like to take a minute on this, Maria, and then give you about five more minutes, and then we're going to go to break. When I teach people media stuff, you almost every sentence that you're giving the press has to not just be something you don't want to be quoted on, it has to be what you want to be quoted on. You have to speak in ways, like if you do an introduction and say, you know, this reminds me of this, and I think there's a deep historical thing, but today we're fighting for this, then the paper comes and they discuss your historical observation when the point was that wasn't what you wanted to talk about. You wanted to talk about, we're demanding that the MTA end the fare hike now. And I worked with Kelly Jenko, who was a GM worker, and they went out to her house in the valley, and she lived in this little tiny, you know, kind of apartment. And in the San Fernando Valley in LA, they got these little ticky-tacky swimming pools because it's 110 degrees. And when she got laid off, in terms of doing a human interest story, the story was Kelly Jenko, sitting by her pool, talked about why she wants her job back at GM. And she said, damn, in the future, I'm only going to say, keep GM Van Nuys open, keep GM Van Nuys open, keep GM, what's your kid's name? Keep GM Van Nuys open. You know, like you really have to stay on message because their goal is to take you, of course, off message. So maybe, why don't you sort of end with, you've had a terrific history. I mean, you know, who you were then and the lessons you've learned have carried you a whole lifetime. Tell our listeners a little bit about the next, 1965, I'm trying to figure out my own history, so 49 years. Quickly, tell us a little bit of how your life's played out.
Certainly, I had always been interested in social justice. That summer put the extra layer of always being on the lookout for racial injustice and having that kind of be the lead. I was not a revolutionary. I chose to work within the system. I became the executive director of a YWCA, founded a domestic violence shelter at a time when that was a very revolutionary act, and we had to do trainings for the police department, letting them know that it really wasn't okay to beat your wife. And went on to do, of course, always continued to do voter education and registration. I resisted impulses to be recruited to run for office over time. I always wanted to be supporting young, diverse leaders, which I still do. I've worked on the campaigns for our current state assemblyman, our young Latina mayor in Watsonville, Karina Cervantes, who I'm very proud of. And for 28 years, I had a consulting firm where I was ostensibly doing a training diversity in fundraising, helping diverse groups to do fundraising, but it really, as my colleagues all said, it was really an anti-racism training in disguise. So I've been inside the system working and drawing people's attention to unfair practices, to unfair policies, and working to actually change them, often as a consultant, mentor, occasionally as an executive director. which is a job I admire you for doing, but my time of doing that many hats is over. I think the main contribution that I've made through the book was to give voice to so many individual people, to fight with my editors and publisher to have the maximum number of people's stories, even if they're small pieces of their stories, so there could be more perspectives and give a window on what it was like to be a young, naive white person and to go through some of that transformation, whether I personally came out still hopeful, you know, discouraged at the end of the summer, but in the bigger picture, optimistic about the potential of what we can do together. And I still am. I really am optimistic about this Sterling controversy because I'm so glad that people are outraged. Yay. But why did it take a rich white man who owns a team to make people outraged? Why aren't they outraged about the comments and policies that we hear and see every day?
Well, the next flyer that I'm reading here that I just wrote is, Adam Silver takes leadership on racism in L.A. Mayor Garcetti needs to take leadership on racism with the Los Angeles MTA.
Terrific.
So as we do our work to fight for the urban poor of color and to do work with black and Latino bus riders to get young kids out of prison for something they did nothing except being poor, black, and Latino, to deal with truancy tickets against young people who are late to school, to deal with willful defiance, which is nothing more than black boys standing up for their own integrity, feels like in some ways everything has changed and nothing has changed. And I'm really happy about the work you've done. And if I can put my own spin on it there, I think you're doing revolutionary work. I think in this country, anything decent right now is revolutionary. So, I want to thank you for all the amazing work you've done. I want to wish you the very best. It sounds like you're a good organizer. You got your husband's friends and the judge and your roommates and anybody else you'll find between now and 7. So check out Esawen Bookstore. Maria, do you have the particular address right in front of you by any chance?
Do I have the address of Esawen Bookstore in front of me?
Don't worry about it. It's everybody will know where it is. ESO.
It's on Degnan Street.
Degnan Street, which
yes,
is
we do have it right here.
Okay.
4327 Degnan, Degnan Boulevard, and I understand you can go straight out San Pedro and get right there in 19 minutes. It says from downtown.
Well, with MapQuest, Eveline. So thanks so much for being on the show, and
thank you,
we'll have you again, Maria.
Okay, thank you.
Take good care.
It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Eric Mann. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. And as I said, my Twitter handle, if I knew what that meant, is at Eric Mann Speaks. We do want you to call in about 5 minutes to 818-985-5735 to talk about the situation with the Los Angeles Clippers still owner, Donald Sterling. The action, I think courageous action, actually, by Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, and what that means for the kind of actions that we can ask of Mark Ridley Thomas, of Mayor Garcetti, of Jackie DuPont Walker, of others in the city, and of Gloria Molina, whose leadership we need in fights right now about the potential increase of the fare at the MTA, about the stop and frisk on passengers on the MTA. So we want to take the victory that was done against Donald Sterling, the racist, and turn it into even more structural victories around the public agency, the MTA, that in our opinion is practicing what we call transit racism. Now, for those of you who don't know the story, I'm just not going to be able to go into it, but you'll pick it up. For those of you who do know the story, I'm going to do the very fastest summary. Donald Sterling is the owner of a basketball team called the Los Angeles Clippers, who are a horrible, horrible team for decades and decades, run by a horrible, horrible man, Donald Sterling, who everybody knew was a horrible, horrible man. I know that he owns big, big apartment buildings and properties in Los Angeles. You know, I don't know all the things he owns. But in the NBA, he's called an owner, which is an interesting term in itself. He owns the team. He owns the coaches. He owns the players. He owns the fans. It's capitalism in its both most transparent and racist form. Sterling was convicted in a federal Justice Department suit in which he discriminated against black and Latino tenants, saying horrible, horrible things about them as people that were caught on tape again. And he was engaged in a settlement. And one of the things you find out in these settlements with the Justice Department is in return for settlements, you don't get convicted. You simply say, well, I settled it. So theoretically, he was not convicted of racial discrimination. But trust me, you got to do something really bad to settle with the Justice Department. So I will say that his policies were racist, his ideology was racist. His treatment of basketball icon Elgin Baylor, who was a vice president of basketball affairs for many years, and the degrading treatment of him, led Elgin Baylor, who was a star with the Los Angeles Lakers, to sue Donald Sterling for racist treatment. He didn't prevail in the courts, but that doesn't mean it wasn't true. The courts are very sympathetic to property. So everybody knew that this guy was a stone racist. Also, there was a player for the Los Angeles Clipper named Baron Davis who went to UCLA. And apparently at Clippers games, while Baron Davis was playing, Sterling was yelling racist epithets and insults to him. Now, over the last 3 years, the team, through only the miracle that eventually, you know, they'll get something right, drafted Blake Griffin, drafted DeAndre Jordan, and through a fluke got Chris Paul, the greatest point guard in the league. This year, they again, through a fluke, got Doc Rivers, one of the very finest coaches, and they made him the vice president of basketball operations. I have to say, I believe Doc Rivers well understood that Donald Sterling was a racist, but I think he was reassured that this man is going to sort of stay out of your way. He's rich, he's eccentric, you know, you are vice president of operations, you have full power in a situation. 4 days ago, a tape was leaked by TMZ, and yes, there are issues about privacy, which we're not going to get into now, but it was leaked because of a fight between his girlfriend and him that she consciously taped, but in which it was provoked by him saying to her, and I won't even repeat most of the things, it's just too heartbreaking, but the essence being, yes, you're black and Mexican, but I don't want you hanging around with blacks and Mexicans, especially in public, and especially Magic Johnson. And then he went on and on. It wasn't just a racist remark, parenthesis, all this crap about racially insensitive. That is a racist concept. There's no such thing as racially insensitive, so don't ever use that word. That's the softening of the racist conversation. And it just went on and on and on. You just saw the mind of a plantation owner, the mind of the degrading of black people, and the mind of a white racist in the sickest form of listening to it unfold. When I first heard it, I was just crying. It's not because it was the worst thing ever done, but maybe it's because it just showed for black people that there is never, ever a time when you're protected from racist thought and racist actions. Now, what's different is that the entire league moved aggressively against Sterling, led by the players. Even the conservative Michael Jordan said he shouldn't be an owner, but LeBron James said there's no way that Donald Sterling should be in the NBA. And then there was all this ridiculous KPFK 98.7, 818-985-5735. Do call in now. All this ridiculous conjecture. Well, the commissioner's hands are tied. Sterling is litigious, and maybe they'll suspend him for the playoffs. Suspend him for the playoffs? Mara Schott, one of the worst racists, was suspended for a year. Well, there's nothing they can do about his ownership because that's under... Basically, everybody was... And as an organizer, I'll tell you, when they don't want to do something, they all tell you how their hands are tied. It's ridiculous. Their hands are never tied. When they want to do something, they'll break any rule, they'll find any rule. When they don't want to do anything, they'll make up their own handcuffs. So today at 11 o'clock Eastern, 2 o'clock Pacific, Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, banned Donald Sterling for life from the NBA and made it very clear that he plans to get rid of him as an owner. very bold stuff in the capitalist world of the NBA owners. And I want to read the statement because the statement is in some way more valuable than all the commentary in terms of what can somebody do when they really want to do something. 818-985-5735. This is now NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, by the way, a Jewish lawyer. And don't ever underestimate, with all the contradictions between Jews and blacks, the tremendous role that Jewish people have done as a group in support of the black community compared to the average white population. Shortly after the release of an audio recording this past Saturday morning of a conversation that allegedly included Clippers owner Donald Sterling, the NBA commenced an investigation which, among other things, included an interview of Mr. Sterling. That investigation is now complete, understand parentheses, in 3 days. They finished it. The central findings of the investigation are that the man whose voice is heard on the recording and on a second recording from the same conversation that was released on Sunday is Mr. Sterling, and that the hateful opinions are voiced by that man are those of Mr. Sterling. The views expressed by Mr. Sterling are deeply offensive and harmful. That they came from an NBA owner only heightens the damage and my personal outrage. 818-985-5735 if you want to comment on this. Sentiments of this kind are contrary to the principles of inclusion and respect that form the foundation of our diverse, multicultural, multi-ethnic league. I am personally distraught that the views expressed by Mr. Sterling came from within an institution that has historically taken such leadership role in matters of race relations. Understand the words outrage and distraught, something you rarely hear. It caused current and former players, fans, and partners of the NBA to question their very association with the league. To them, and pioneers of the game, like Earl Floyd, Chuck Cooper, Sweetwater Clifton, and the great Bill Russell, and particularly Magic Johnson, I apologize. 818-985-5735. Accordingly, effective immediately, I am banning Mr. Sterling for life from any association with the Clippers organization or the NBA. Mr. Sterling may not attend NBA games or practices. He may not be present at any Clippers facility. He may not participate in any business or player personnel decisions involving the team. He will also be barred from attending NBA Board of Governors meetings or participating in any other league activities. I am also fining Mr. Sterling $2.5 million, the maximum amount allowed under NBA Constitution. Parenthesis, note the owners have protected themselves on that. These funds will be donated to organizations dedicated to anti-discrimination and tolerance efforts that will be jointly selected by the NBA and its Players Association. As for Mr. Sterling's ownership interest in the Clippers, I will urge the Board of Governors to exercise its authority to force a sale of the team, and I will do everything in my power to ensure that it happens. This has been a painful moment for all members of the NBA family. I appreciate the support and understanding of our players during this process. I'm particularly grateful for the leadership shown by Doc Rivers, Union President Chris Paul, and Mayor Kevin Johnson of Sacramento, who's been acting as the players' representative in this manner. We stand together in condemning Mr. Sterling's views. They simply have no place in the NBA. I have lots of things I could say beyond that, but I really want to make sure our listeners have a chance, so let's go to the phones. 818-985-5735. Got a lot of them. John in Los Angeles. If we can ask everybody for 2 minutes, I want to make sure as many people get in as possible. Hi, John.
How you doing? No problem. I just want to say that I just get tired of the race thing being the issue. The way I feel about this guy is he's typical of rich people. Racism is just a cover for social economic disparities and rate. I wouldn't call it racism, but whatever that is, class warfare. And he's just the ugliest of it. And you know what? A lot of NBA football owners are like that.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for making sure that we don't discuss race on an anti-racist show. I appreciate it. Chris from Irvine.
Oh, my God, that was priceless. I was pretty horrified by the whole thing, but I just wanted to get your take on the fact that a lot of people on the social media are trying to say that it's about freedom of speech, which just amazed me, and I'm almost at a loss to how to respond to people like that.
Well,
he said, oh, he can say what he wants. It's a free country. He didn't know he was being taped, and, you know, this and that. It was horrible. horrible what they said, but that's what seems to be going around social media.
Well, one thing to remember is that we just had a caller who has free speech, and he said it's not about race. You can't, in a racist country, worry about their attitudes. You have your own. Speak to people. Join civil rights organizations. Yes, there are, quote, issues involved. But if a billionaire is speaking into a taped situation under the, quote, First Amendment of the press, they got it. And once, as Adam Silver said as a lawyer, once it's in the public domain, it's a reality. And if all you're worried about is a billionaire's right versus all the attacks on black people, don't engage these people on social media. It's just going to give you an ulcer. Join the Strategy Center and get involved in the civil rights movement. You're great. Next.
All right, thanks.
Okay, Louise from Whittier.
Yeah, hi, Eric. I, too, agree. We don't want to reify the concept of race because racism is a very real thing. And so I'm surprised that he got banned for life. I wasn't expecting it to go that far, but that shows the power of the African-American communities and all minorities, including African-Americans and Mexican-Americans, because we are both national minorities. And let me add, having said that, let me just add this. I'm also distraught and outraged that after you personally told me that you would not be conflating Mexican-Americans, national minority, with the term Latinos, I know your ideological reasons for doing that, but I took you at your word that you would say Mexican-Americans, and if you want to say Latinos, you're free to say whatever you want to say.
Thank you very much, Luis. Because of the 2 minutes, I just don't know, folks. Let's talk to each other. An attack has happened on the black community. So far, we have one person who wants to fight with me over one word. Another person doesn't want to talk about race. You have free speech, but so do I. Could anybody give a damn about what's happening to the black community? Next listener, Guadalupe from Duarte.
Hi. Hi. How you doing? Well, I just want to talk about the silence from all the highest players in the NBA. Nobody said anything after Elgin Baylor. And it's a silence that's going on for a long time, and they're never going to say anything until something as big as this comes out, and they're never going to say anything because they're afraid because they're on the payroll, and so I'm sorry that it has to wait because we had to wait so long for this to happen.
Well, I think what you're right about is look. You know it's only when they get caught in the most egregious verbal slips that everybody has to rally around. That there was a woman, I'm sorry, I got to learn her name on ESPN, a black woman, who said, where was the NAACP in Los Angeles knowing that he had moved against black and Latino poor people and gave him a lifetime achievement award? This was on ESPN. She says, now, they moved against black millionaires. Obviously, we agree with that. But why doesn't the black community fight more for the black poor and Latinos? And the NAACP hypocrisy of giving him a lifetime achievement award now allegedly today demonstrating in front of Staples Center. We have to ask the NAACP, which side are they on in Los Angeles? And of course, we have to ask the white liberals, where have you been on anything about race in Los Angeles? Next, Bill in Santa Monica.
Hello, Eric. I'd like to ask you, who in the past few weeks has done more harm to black people? Sterling with his comments, or Scalia and Alito and Roberts and Kennedy and that Uncle Tom Clarence Thomas? I mean, that's where the energy should go with their decision on Michigan, or you can take it further to the American people and democracy with their decision on the McCumber case. And I don't understand all the energy about this guy. This guy can hurt anyone. He hurt people already when wouldn't let them live in their apartments, and not a thing was said. But yet, he comes out and says something in private about his girlfriend going out with black guys, and the world's coming to an end. All of a sudden, he's the worst person in the country because he's a soft target where Scalia and those other scumbags on the Supreme Court, those five scumbags I named, they're the people this energy should be directed at.
All right, good point. Let me respond to it. We have a leaflet that we're going to be putting out saying Adam Silver takes leadership on racism in L.A. Mayor Garcetti needs to take leadership on racism at the MTA. What we're all saying is that it's not a question this is a soft target. This is a very important historical moment. Don't compare it to something else. It's a great victory for the black community. It's a great victory for the anti-racist movement. It's those of us in the anti-racist movement who don't say, well, this was an easy one. For the people who made these decisions, it was a hard one. It's our job to now force these forces when the initiative is starting to move the direction in the direction of the black and Latino poor, but not by contradicting the terrible pain that black middle-class people also face in this country. I got one more and one more minute. I'm going to go to Andrea in Los Angeles. I think, Andrea, you have the last word.
So happy that I have the last word, because as a black woman, I just got in my car and I heard what you said, Eric, when you started reading the statement, and I, for one, started screaming. Like, I cannot believe it. Thank God he stood up. Thank God he represented right. It's like, I am emotional about this. This is one of those things where people need to understand that we get kicked and slapped all the time, and we're expected to just, like, not make any waves, not say anything, because then there's the reverse racism backlash. But I just want to commend the commissioner for doing the right thing for the right reason. God bless him.
And God bless you, because I think the lesson we're getting out of this is that it's not either or in most things. We're building a movement, and this outrage now has to continue against the system. But yeah, within the limits of who Adam Silver was, he did as good as it can be done. And trust me, nobody thought he would suspend Sterling for life. Nobody thought he would suspend him for life, and nobody said, I promise that I'm going to get rid of this guy. This is unusual, and we shouldn't have a moment of enjoyment as we move on, Angela, to the next fight. Thank you so much. Okay, everybody, I'm getting all the waves. As always, wonderful listeners, thank you so much. This is Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines, a very emotionally draining show. I want to thank Maria Guyton, who was on the show today. Go check her out at S1 tonight at 7. Get her book, This Bright Light of Ours. I mean it. Tweet to Adam Silver and to the NBA and to Doc Rivers and to the Go Clippers tonight. Win that game and fight back. And, and next Tuesday, Alan Minsky and I are going to be on the Fund Drive, which is part of the programming here. Let's raise a whole lot of money for KPFK and keep Voices from the Frontlines going. Thanks to our engineer, G. All power to the people.